The American diet has changed a lot in the last few decades. All it takes is a look at recipes from the 50s and 60s to really be sure of that. One of the wonderful additions to the American diet has been food from the Mediterranean region. And I think one of the most successful transplants to the American plate has been olive oil. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nancy Harmon Jenkins is a writer, traveler, food authority, and historian. She's the author of several books on Mediterranean culture and cuisine, including her latest, Virgin Territory, Exploring the World of Olive Oil. Nancy divides her time between an olive farm in Tuscany and a home in Maine, both of which sound absolutely wonderful to me. Nancy, it's a pleasure to have you join us today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, this is going to be a lot of fun, I think. And, you know, March 19th today is St. Joseph's Day, which is
absolutely,
it's
yes,
a big holiday for Italians and Italian Americans. It certainly seems like a good time to talk about olive oil. How key to Italian cuisine would you say olive oil is today?
Oh, I think it's fundamental. I mean, there are parts of Italy where olive oil isn't used much, particularly in the north, where people might use butter or pork fat. But olive oil is really predominant everywhere, Tuscany, Umbria, and all the south. So it's really a basic and has been for a long time.
Well, that's a perfect lead-in. Let's go back a few thousand years. What do we know about olive oil in those earlier Mediterranean cultures?
Well, we know that it was always, I mean, if you go back to ancient Rome, the amount of olive oil that was imported from North Africa under the Roman Empire was just extraordinary, especially, interestingly enough, from Libya, but also from Tunisia. Poor Tunisia. Mm-hmm. Terrible news in Tunisia today. But the olive oil from Tunisia continues to be wonderful and a great buy for Americans, too, incidentally. But the Romans really searched the world because, you know, they had to supply their armies, and their armies went out all over the known world in order to protect the Roman Empire. So they had to have wheat and they had to have olive oil. And the olive oil was critical to it because you cannot live on wheat alone, even though you might want to try. The olive oil is what makes the wheat go down.
And so what was the trade? I mean, they were trading to get a lot of this, but so was olive oil really one of the major kind of currencies in the ancient world?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that it was. Olive oil and wheat. I don't want to diminish the importance of wheat, mm-hmm. but that was also very important. But another place where they got a lot of oil was the south of Spain, where we get most of our olive oil today in the world. Something over 50% of all of our oil comes from Spain, and most of that comes from Andalusia, which is the great province that runs across the south of the Iberian Peninsula. And the Romans had so much coming in from there that there's this wonderful scene in Rome. If you go to Rome, you want to go and look for the Monte Testaccio, because the testacci were the remains of broken amphorae that had been filled with olive oil. Mm. And they formed a complete mountain on the, I think it's on the right bank of the Tiber. I'm never sure whether I'm on the right bank or the left bank, but it's very well known. And you can go there and you can see these testacci sticking up out of the soil. And archaeologists have investigated, and they found many of them are inscribed with the name of the person who made the oil and the weight that was in the amphora and the shipping date and all that kind of information that we look for today when
right.
we go to buy olive oil. They were looking for back then, too.
Wow, that's incredible. And there, you talked about the archaeological finds. They have found things much further afield that indicate use of olive oil as well.
I mean, I've been to an olive mill in Morocco, a Roman olive mill. I can't remember the name of it right now, but that's all right. And it's not unique. There are these olive. Oh, it's in Volubilis.
Volubilis, actually, yeah, I have been there. Yes.
Oh, that's a wonderful place, isn't it?
It is.
And you can see how important olive oil was because this whole little fortified town built up around the processing of olive oil there. And Morocco, of course, to this day produces a great deal of olive oil. And then you go to the other end of the Mediterranean to Israel and Palestine, and you can find there much older remains. I mean, some remains going back to the Neolithic period that indicate that people were harvesting olives and making oil from them, even back then.
Amazing. And your first epiphany of what really wonderful olive oil can be was when you were in Lebanon. Can you describe that for us?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, Spaniards get very angry when I talk about this. But, you know, when I lived in Spain, it was under the Franco dictatorship. I was there twice under the Franco dictatorship. And the dictatorship really controlled the food supply. So all the olive oil was, you know, the government set the price. And so there was no reason to make great olive oil unless you were making it for your own family. So all of the olive oil just about in Spain was really horrible. It was rancid, and it also was fusty, which is what happens when there's too long a period of time between the harvest of the olives and the crushing of them. They start to ferment, and that fermentation odor and flavor is what gets into them and calls them fusty. So I never bothered with olive oil when I was in Spain. I would now, but then, because the olive oil has improved enormously over the years. But back then, I didn't bother with it. And then I was married to a foreign correspondent, so we bounced around the Mediterranean from post to post. And after Madrid, we were sent to Beirut. And there I discovered from my Lebanese friends what a fabulous product Lebanese olive oil is. They would go up into the mountains in the late fall, early winter to get, I mean, these are city dwellers I'm talking about, doctors at the American University Hospital and professors and things like that. They all had families up in the mountains, and they would go up to the mountains to stock up on their supplies for the winter. And the most critical supply was olive oil, and it was just beautiful stuff. So that's when I learned that olive oil was really something to pay attention to.
And something to actually seek out.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
We are talking with Nancy Harmon Jenkins. She's a writer, traveler, food authority, and historian. She's the author of several books on Mediterranean culture and cuisine, including her latest, which is just a gorgeous book, Virgin Territory, Exploring the World of Olive Oil. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of olive oil? We'd love to hear your favorite uses for it. Or maybe if you have a country of origin of olive oil that is your favorite, we'd love to hear why. Or maybe you're just not sure what all the fuss is about. Nancy is happy to answer your questions, and we will be sharing some recipes a little later in the hour as well. So, Nancy, I also thought one of the interesting things that you really bring out in your book is that until recently, the main uses for olive oil were not actually for cooking and eating. What was olive oil used for before?
Well, that was a long time ago.
Right.
That was when the Greeks were ruling Athens, which, of course, the Greeks still rule Athens. But in classical times, olive oil was often used used for lighting. A lot of olive oil was used for lighting, especially bad oil. It didn't turn out very well. You find these little olive lamps all over the Mediterranean in various sites, whether Greek or Roman, and they usually had olive oil in them because there wasn't any other kind of oil to put in. But the other major use of it was for cleaning, especially cleaning the body. And I love this image of the Greek athletes, you know, after they had been in a competition and they were all sweaty and hot and covered with dust from the arena, they would coat their bodies with olive oil and then use this interesting instrument called a strigil, S-T-R-I-G-I-L, which is kind of like a blunt razor. And they would use that to scrape the oil and the dust and the sweat off their bodies and leave themselves with skin as supple as a newborn baby and, you know, smelling nicely of olive oil instead of old sweat.
Wow. And it's also been used in ceremonial and especially
yes,
religious.
Yes, that's a very important use for it. And that goes to the sacredness, the sacred nature of olive oil, which is also true of the other two pillars of the Mediterranean diet, of wheat. You know, you think of the wafer in the communion mass or the challah that's baked on Friday for the Saturday. Those are all indications of how wheat was sacred, but olive oil was used in biblical times. In the Old Testament, they describe the anointing of the kings of Israel with olive oil. And even to this day, I think the kings and queens of England are anointed with olive oil, too. Excuse me. But it is also definitely used to anoint priests when they become priests, that is, you know, not later, but when they take up orders and they're anointed with olive oil, it's used to baptize babies, and it's used to anoint the dying.
Yes.
It's the unction, divine mm-hmm. unction, is the distribution of olive oil in certain parts of the body as a way of preparing the body for death, really.
Mm-hmm. So it really, I mean, it's just key to the cultures of
yes.
that area so much.
Absolutely. So much so that it has entered. I mean, I think one reason, we know that one reason why there were olive trees in California from very early years is because the Spanish priests took the trees there to plant because they needed the oil for their various ceremonial uses.
Interesting. Wow. So it was really the more ceremonial uses that brought them to this country.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Absolutely.
So what is it about the Mediterranean climate? And here we've talked about pretty much every country that touches the Mediterranean producing oil or olives in some, you know, some percentage. What is it about that Mediterranean climate that makes it so good for olive growing?
Well, it's very simple. It's cool but not cold winters, and it's hot, dry summers, and that's the with very dry soil. That's the olive tree's preferred environment, and that's why the olive tree really is a native to the Mediterranean. I just got back from the Pacific Northwest, from Portland, Oregon, where there are people who are actually growing olive trees up there now, although they're not having a lot of good luck with it. I mean, one man said he'd planted 1,500 trees, and he's got 360 left.
Oh, dear.
So I'm not sure that Oregon is the right climate for olive trees, but California certainly is. And California olive oil is just growing by leaps and bounds. One of the major Australian producers of olive oil has just bought a huge amount of territory in California with the idea of making oil there. So it's, you know, people who are in the business of olive oil, as opposed to those of us who kind of grow olives for a hobby and love the oil we make, but people who are in the business really recognize that it's a growing phenomenon and that they're going to have to supply it.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned California, Australia, also New Zealand, but also places as far-flung as South Africa, Chile, Argentina.
Yeah.
That's getting up there in parts of the world where olives are being grown.
That's true, but almost always in situations, and certainly in Australia, New Zealand, parts of California, Chile for sure. I've never visited Argentina, I mean, for olive oil. And South Africa are places where you can find this Mediterranean climate in which the olive tree flourishes. And so I think we're probably going to be seeing more and more, especially what they call Southern Hemisphere oils, which are the oils from south of the equator, because they come into our markets 6 months after the Mediterranean olives come in, and that means that we have a fresh infusion of really fresh olive oil.
Oh, that's right. So because their growing seasons are opposite.
Right, yeah. So they're harvesting in April and May, and the olive oil usually gets here around July.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending on who's made it and how they've made it, it's usually a pretty good deal.
Oh, well, we will talk more about that in just a moment. We are talking with Nancy Harmon Jenkins, a writer, traveler, food authority, and historian. She's the author of several books on Mediterranean culture and cuisine, including her latest, Virgin Territory, Exploring the World of Olive Oil. We are happily exploring that world with Nancy right now. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also comment on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. Michelle Good, our on-air producer. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. I hope you'll stay tuned because coming up at 11:45, Rick Cini of FairCompare.com is here with great travel advice. But right now, we are traveling vicariously to the lands of olive oil with Nancy Harmon Jenkins. She is the author of Virgin Territory, Exploring the World of Olive Oil. And Nancy, we do have some callers who'd like to join in, so let's go to the phone. Alex in Shawano is up first. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering about transferring the olive oil across the Mediterranean in olden days through these clay amphora jars. And they didn't use glass glazes back then on jars. So how did they keep the oil in those porous clay jars from seeping through?
Hmm.
That's a question I'm afraid I cannot answer. I have wondered about that myself. But the same thing with wine. I mean, they stored and transferred oil in these big terracotta jars from very early times. You know, if you go to the island of Crete, to the palace of Knossos, you will see those giant jars, we call them amphorae, in which olive oil, it's presumed that olive oil was stored. Why didn't it leak out? I don't know. Was it any good when it got to where it was shipped to?
Was there any left in it?
Yes, exactly.
But that's a great point. I mean, there's the oil, but then there was the wine, too. And
yes,
I would think actually wine would seep through even faster because it's thinner. It's not as thick.
Yeah, you'd see a little purplish haze forming on the outside of your amphora. I can't answer that. I'm sorry to say. It's a very good question. If you find the answer, I would like to know.
Well, and I will say, Nancy, we have an incredible bunch of listeners, and I'm wondering if we don't have an ancient history professor out there who's listening.
Oh, you do.
Who could,
you
who
know,
could call in.
I was in Madison many, many years ago, and I took a Greek newspaper article about the use of oil in ancient times to the head of the department, of the Greek department, and asked him if he would translate it for me, and he said yes, he would, and he did it very nicely, and it was very interesting, and he turned out to be one of the men who had translated Linear B.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm forever grateful to Madison. Do you also know about the Madison connection with one of the olive oil makers that I write about?
No.
Nasser Abu Farha, he's a Palestinian. He has his PhD from Madison in anthropology, I think. And his PhD, the dissertation was published as a book called The Making of a Human Bomb, because he was interested as a Palestinian in what on earth persuades people to do these terrible things. And out of that, he gained the conviction that really what you need to do is to supply people with a way to earn a living and something dignified to do. And so he went back to northern Palestine and he started this cooperative of olive oil makers. And now they're making some very good olive oil called Canaan. We would call it Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
Their trade. And he had a restaurant in Madison for a number of years, a Middle Eastern restaurant, when he was a graduate student. So there's your Madison connection.
So there's our Madison connection. Well, hopefully a Wisconsin connection will come up with the answer to how they kept those liquids inside those clay jars. Let's go back to Kenneth, the phones, and Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I noticed olive oil is about half the price of what it has been for the last 5 or 10 years, and I was wondering how long does olive oil last unopened?
Oh, okay. So
that's
you're thinking
question.
Of stacking up.
It lasts. It depends on how it's been treated. I have had olive oil that I've kept for 4 or 5 years, but I've kept it sealed in a jar or in a stainless steel container in a dark, cool pantry or cellar. The problem, one of the big problems with olive oil is that the person who's producing the olive oil may make a delicious oil, wonderful oil, but once it's left his or her hands, there's no control over what happens to it. So it can be exposed to light and it can be exposed to heat, both of which are really detrimental to the quality of the oil. So, you know, if you see an oil that's old but at a low price, I would ask to taste it before buying it. Mm. And most shopkeepers don't want to do that.
That's true.
You just have to, you know, kick and scream and say, if it's any good, I'll buy 6 bottles from you or something like that. I would tend to steer away from it unless you know the person who is actually selling it.
Well, and Kenneth is saying that the olive oil right now is half price compared to last year. Is there a reason why the price would be so much lower, Nancy?
No, it shouldn't be.
Okay.
It absolutely should not be. It should be higher now than last year because we've had a disastrous year in Europe, just disastrous, with the Italian production cut by 50 or 40%, Spanish production cut by 50%, and therefore the price should be going up. There's almost no oil produced in France.
Mm.
And, yes, the dollar to euro rate is much better than it has been for a long time. But I don't think that that can make up for the lack of product, basically, is what we're talking about.
Well, and that last season's harvest where it was so much less than expected, what happened? What were the conditions that produced
it? It was a disaster, a multiple of disasters. Mostly what happened to the harvest in Italy and France was the invasion of this thing called the olive fly, Bactrocera Olier. I'm probably mispronouncing the Latin, but it's a fly that gets into the olive. It lays an egg inside an olive. The egg hatches a worm, and the worm eats its way around the inside of the olive and eventually falls out and goes into the ground and reemerges the following spring as another fly to begin the whole wretched cycle over again. So that's what attacked olive trees in central Italy and France, and also to a certain extent in southern Italy. It has been known in the past, but usually winters are so severe that they kill these things off, except in very low-lying hot areas. Actually, very hot areas the fly doesn't like. It likes low-lying areas with a moderate temperature. Instead, we had a very warm winter last year in central Italy, and that increased the amount of this, and it really was quite devastating. In Spain, you had another problem, which was drought, which has been ongoing there for 4 or 5 years, and it's a little bit like the drought in California. It's gotten quite critical, and the Spanish harvest, according to everything that I've read, was half what it should have been.
And you said that, is it 50% of the world's olive oil supply?
Yes,
comes
a little
from,
over. I think it's more like
comes from Spain.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's really significant. Actually, Catherine in Madison has a question that goes along with that. So let's go back to the phones.
Right. Actually, there's been a report put out that 70% of the extra virgin olive oil is adulterated, cut with cheaper oils. 70%. So that's why he's not getting real virgin olive oil.
Well, that 70%, the report was not that 70% of extra virgin olive oils are adulterated. It was that 70% of the oils tested in about 5 California supermarkets of the European oils were not adulterated but didn't meet the criterion, no longer met the criterion for extra virgin. And that means that they were old, they had been stored too long, they may have been extra virgin when they started out, but they weren't anymore when they got to the consumer. So that study has been misinterpreted over and over again. Just remember that it's not 70% of all extra virgin olive oil, and it's not that it's adulterated. It's that it doesn't meet the criteria for extra virgin.
So now, you don't want people...
It might be adulterated, too, but that's not what the test was for.
Okay. And, Catherine, you had a question about the drought? Hello? All right. I think Catherine also was going to ask about the drought's effect, the California drought's effect on those kind of booming olive groves.
Well, it's hard to say. I think the more northern groves have had a pretty good year. Maybe not as good as last year, but a pretty good year. And I'm thinking specifically of California Olive Ranch, which is a very big producer, owned by Spanish, by the way. And the other one is one of my favorite California oils. It's called Seca Hills, and it's made by an American Indian tribe in the Capay Valley, which is north of Sacramento. They both had pretty good years. I have heard, and I'm not sure that this is true, that McAvoy Ranch, which is one of the big producers of premium oil in California, didn't have a harvest this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And also, olive trees take a long time, and they're not a quick crop.
No, they're not, although I've seen olive plantations in Chile that were planted 3 or 4 years ago, and they're already getting a harvest off them. I couldn't believe it, but I think they're dumping water on them, and they're dumping probably something to make them grow.
We are talking with Nancy Harmon Jenkins. She's a writer, traveler, food authority, and historian, and the author, most recently, of Virgin Territory, Exploring the World of Olive Oil. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. Nancy, you bought a farm in eastern Tuscany in the early 1970s, I believe, and it came with a few olive trees, but you barely noticed them at first.
That's true. I mean, they hadn't been very well tended. We are up quite high on that farm. We're up at about 2,000 feet, which is, at the time, was considered very high for cultivating olives. Everybody in our village had 3 or 4 or 5 trees, but nobody was very serious about growing olive oil. Mostly, they used pork fat for their cooking, and or they bought olive oil from relatives who lived farther down. So I was struggling with how to maintain this land that I bought, 25 acres, and I was trying to get the neighbor to pay attention to it because he's supposed to be managing it, and I was always at the bottom of his to-do list. So I decided I would plant something that would call his attention, and at first it was going to be grapes, and then I thought, oh, God, you know, grapes is so much work. And then I thought, olives, of course. So I planted olives. I planted 150 trees. And they all said, oh, this will never, never flourish here. They said the cold will get them, the wild boar will knock them over, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they have flourished, and we now get a harvest every year toward the end of October. We get anywhere from 100 to 130 liters of fresh oil.
Wow. So let's go through the process of making oil. You actually say in Virgin Territory that you start making oil in March. What do you mean by that?
Well, because that's when you prune the trees. And pruning the trees doesn't have to happen every year, but it should probably happen every other year. I have some trees that are due for pruning this year, and I have to get moving on them. You know, we're still covered in snow in Maine, so it's hard to think that anywhere in the world they're pruning olive trees. So you start by pruning the trees to encourage the new growth, because it's on the new growth that the olives actually take shape. But then after that, you don't have to do much of anything until harvest time. You keep the grass pretty clean underneath, and we occasionally, every other year or so, we give them a dose of organic fertilizer, but that's about all we ever do with them. And then the real work comes in October when we have to harvest, and that's an intense period of about 4 or 5 days, because you want to get those olives into the mill as quickly as you possibly can, because that's one of the basic things that determines quality, is that speed with which those people at the California Olive Ranch, for instance, in California, they press oil from their olives within 2 hours of harvest.
Oh, wow.
We, up in our little farm in Tuscany, we take maybe 3 or 4 days before we can get them pressed. But the quicker, the better.
And so where do you get them pressed?
Oh, we have a frantoio. It's an Italian word for an olive mill, down in the valley. We actually live near the town of Cortona, and this olive mill is in Cortona. And one reason I like the mill is because it gives us an option of pressing the old-fashioned way or the modern way. I prefer the modern way, and I finally managed to persuade my children that that's the best way to do it. It's much cleaner. It's much faster. I think it produces a much better product. And the old-fashioned way was to crush the olives with a stone for hours and hours, and then to take the paste that resulted and spread it on mats and stack those mats up and put them in a hydraulic press and slowly squeeze so that the vegetable water and the olive oil came out. And it took hours, and all that time the olives and the paste and the oil were exposed to light and heat and humidity in the olive mill. Excuse me. So when they put in what's called a continuous cycle olive mill, I rush to do that. And that's much faster, as I said, because you dump the olives, clean olives in at one end, and it's almost like a bread machine. You push a button, and a couple of hours, maybe an hour and a half later, out the other end comes fresh olive oil.
So last weekend I was watching Friends boil down maple sap to make maple syrup, and it's incredible how much sap you need to make a gallon of syrup. What's the ratio of olives to oil produced?
Well, we like to have a ratio of 12 or 14%. That is, 100 kilos of olives will produce 12 to 14 kilos or 12 to 14 liters, conveniently, of oil. This year we had a very low yield because we harvested early since we were afraid of the olive fly. So we harvested really around the 15th or 18th of October, I think, and our yield was only 8%. Now, that's no way to make a living out of making olive oil, but fortunately I make my living in other ways.
And then how do you store the oil?
I put it into tins. I put it into 3-liter tins, and everybody who comes to harvest gets a 3-liter tin to take away with them. Then I ship back to the States. My daughter has a restaurant in New York, so she uses the olive oil in her restaurant, not to cook with, but to garnish, to give to favored customers, that kind of thing. So she gets quite a chunk of it, and then my son gets another chunk of it for his cooking, and I get a third chunk, and then some of it is left there in the house so that when we go back, we've got olive oil ready for us. It's always stored in what they call fusti, which are stainless steel containers that can be as much as 30 or even 50 liters.
Mm, wow. Well, Dwight in Duluth actually has a question about storage of olive oil, so let's go back to the phones. Hi, Dwight. Dwight, are you there?
Dwight went away.
All right. Dwight said that he bought a box of olive oil, and he's wondering what the shelf life is in that kind of vessel.
Well, a box, meaning like an aseptic packaging, is that what he means?
Possibly. Well, let's talk about that, a box versus, say, a tin.
Yeah, that Seca Hills that I was talking about to you, and I think several other of the California olive makers, olive oil makers, are going in for this bag-in-box packaging, which is a really good idea. I had a 3-liter bag-in-box from Seca Hills, and you just put it on your counter. It's got a little spigot in it, and you tap out what you need, and the bag that's inside collapses over the oil, so the oil inside is never exposed to the atmosphere. And that's really great. I think it's a terrific thing, especially, I think, for restaurants. It's a really good idea to have olive oil like that because, you know, you've got olive oil in the kitchen. In a restaurant, it can get really, really hot.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure you're not exposing too much of your oil to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very convenient to have in a home kitchen as well.
Let's go back to the phones and Barbara in Eau Claire. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I grew up in an Albanian home in Buffalo, New York, and my mother did not learn English. But I was wondering with your guest if she knows on the religious part, particularly women that would burn olive oil in like a little container with a wick in front of an icon, because that's what my mother, I believe, did.
Oh,
I always remember this smell through the house. It was different than Americans.
Well, yeah, she probably was burning oil in the lamp, you know.
We had many foods cooked with olive oil during lunch. She was very strict about that, rice and beans, and a totally different thing. I just read that in the 2013 election in Albania, olive oil was a big political issue, whether the Albanians should join the European market should invest more in that industry.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Oh,
that would change the industry in Albania probably a lot.
Well, and Albania is, you know, it's a little up on the, was it the Dalmatian coast there? But certainly part of the Mediterranean. So
yeah. That
makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much for that, Barbara. And guess what, Nancy? Someone has an answer for us about how they kept those amphorae from leaking.
Fantastic.
So let's go to Ron in Mason.
Okay.
Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Hi.
Our college professor said that when they dug up a couple of pharaohs, mitre pharaohs in Egypt, and they found out that the tombs, the canisters that they kept the oil in and the wine in were still palatable, and that was because of beeswax. They would coat the inside.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting, because that would also probably give the olive oil a really delightful flavor.
I would think, yeah.
Wow. Well, Ron, thank you so much. You've saved us from wondering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I knew somebody would come through for us.
Of course.
Nancy. So we only have, about 5 more minutes, but I want to make sure we touch on a few kind of key things. One, Mark from Winneconne said, please discuss different grades of olive oil and their uses in cooking.
Okay, there's only one.
Okay.
Extra virgin.
Okay. Well, what about for things like high temperature cooking?
Absolutely. Extra virgin is stable up to about 410, 415 degrees.
Okay.
And according to the Joy of Cooking, for deep fat frying, you don't want your fat to be over 360 degrees.
Oh.
So there's plenty of room there.
And also,
because olive oil has a lot of polyphenols and antioxidants in it, it's a more stable oil than those that lack that. There's a big myth out there about how you can't cook with extra virgin olive oil, which is just crazy. Absolutely crazy.
So what do we mean by extra virgin? What you said before that that kind of tempest in a teapot controversy about extra virgin oils. You said that they might not any longer meet the criteria. What are the criteria?
Well, the criteria, the two major criteria, there are a bunch of chemical analyses that can be done. The major one is the presence of free oleic fatty acids, and that doesn't mean that the oil tastes acidic at all. It has nothing to do with acidity. It means that the oleic acid has been released from its chemical bond, and the International Olive Council, which governs these things, allows a percentage of 0.8 of free oleic fatty acid in the oil. That's much higher than most quality producers want to go. Quality producers around 0.1 or 0.2, not much higher than that. The other is the peroxide content of the oil, which again is a measure of rancidity, of oxidation. And that, the Olive Council allows that to go up to 20 MEP. I can't tell you what MEP means, but you're allowed 20. Well, most good producers want that MEP to be around 8, 9, no more than 10. So the parameters for extra virgin are actually very, very broad. Then, on top of that, it's supposed to have perfect flavor and aroma. No defects at all, no rancidity, no fustiness, no flavor of vinegar or must or dirt at all. And then, of course, because it's virgin, it has to be produced virtually by hand by that process I described. The other oils, plain olive oil, for instance, is a rectified oil. It's been rectified using chemicals to remove nasty flavors and aromas. So we don't want to use that at all. We want to use only extra virgin, because only extra virgin has both the monounsaturated fats that help to keep our cholesterol under control and these a critical antioxidants that help defend us against all kinds of inflammatory diseases.
And I've actually seen filtered or unfiltered oil. Do you have a preference, or when
would
you use
each? Well, it depends on how old it is. If it's a fresh oil, I would take unfiltered. If it's an older oil, I think it should be filtered, because the particles of whatever in there, you know, particles of olive, basically, is what they are. They can help. They can kind of rancidify the oil. So if you're looking at an oil that's a year and a half old, it would be nicer to have it filtered.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking at a very fresh oil right out of the mill, the flavor of the unfiltered oil, the unfiltered oil is just fabulous.
You were kind enough to share a couple recipes with our listeners, and we're so short on time, we're not going to be able to go through them in detail, but they are available on the program note for today's show. People can find that at WPR.org, then /shows/wonders-olive.oil. It's also linked right from the Facebook page. A couple that you shared are oven-braised artichokes with potatoes and onions, and then an oven-roasted fish. To me, I can't think of anything that sounds more deliciously Mediterranean than oven-braised artichokes. Can you just give us a little hint of that recipe?
Well, gosh, I can't remember what it was. You know, these recipes are things that I'm constantly working on. But basically, what you're doing is taking artichokes and quartering them, or even cutting them in eighths, and slicing up some potatoes and some onions and tossing them all together with olive oil and some fresh herbs, you know, some parsley or some thyme or a little garlic maybe, and putting them in a baking dish and baking them in the oven with a third of a cup of olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
And you bake them in the oven for, I'm just looking, about 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you bake them in the oven until they're done, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the recipe says you should cover the dish when you put it in the oven and bake them for 30 minutes and then take the cover off, like a piece of foil that you
mm-hmm.
put over it. Take that off and then roast them at higher heat until they get nice and crispy brown on the outsides.
And then there's also a little dash of lemon juice, which I just love to kind of wake up all those flavors.
Well, lemon juice, I think, is absolutely critical in an awful lot of it goes so well with olive oil. And it's critical in an awful lot, especially vegetable dishes,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Well, Nancy, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Nancy Harmon Jenkins is a traveler, a writer, a food authority and historian. She's the author of several books on Mediterranean culture and cuisine, including her latest, which is Virgin Territory, Exploring the World of Olive Oil. And she spends her time between an olive farm in Tuscany and a home in Maine. Well, that was certainly a mouth-watering segment. It's so wonderful to be able to bring the flavors of the world right into your kitchen and onto your dinner table. But sometimes you want to go experience those meals at the source. And that's where Rick Cini comes in. Rick is the CEO of FairCompare.com, and he will be with us with great travel advice in just a moment.